Can't you see it? A glistening 100-megawatt solar field begging to be built? It's photovoltaic modules and balance of system powering a renewable energy tomorrow that's squeaky clean? We know that unless you have the right supplier, that world might just be a fantasy. But here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
David W. Cobb, new dad. Cobb, good day, sir.
Hey, good day, Jeffrey. I've got more bags under my eyes and more gray in my hair than I did the last time we talked, but man, life is good.
Are you doing the new dad twiddling your thumbs and feeling helpless because in the end, like, your wife's going to be the one feeding the kid at night and just kind of like you wake up feeling guilty about every 3 hours?
So the middle of the nights, I am out. Like, I've gotten on to melatonin to help me sleep through that middle of the night feeding. But I'm carrying my weight in the evenings, so letting Sarah get to bed early. So Rosie and I are watching a lot of college basketball together right now. She's really impressed with what the SEC has been doing in this SEC challenge. She's been really impressed by that. I have too. And so I'm trying to pull my weight with the dishes, with the trash, with the diaper genie. But man, you're right. Like, there is only so much that the men can do.
And early for sure, yeah.
Rosie and I, you know, I'm doing diapers.
Yep.
Somehow I'm the one who got sick. Like, you know, and thank goodness it was me and not mom or baby. But there were a couple days there early this week where I got a runny nose and it's like, should I even touch the baby? You know, so that only compounded the feeling of like, man, what am I even doing?
Yeah, these first 3 or 4 months are pretty brutal. It gets better. I can safely say it gets way better. So we'll talk about a few things. Cobb mentions the ACC-SEC challenge. Talk about that a little bit, probably getting into the list, because there's a few things that I kind of big picture takeaways that I wanted to discuss from that. But I wanted to start with a few things happening locally, then we'll maybe get into the viewing guide for this weekend. Eric's going to join us here in about 30 minutes or so. The Grizzlies tonight taking on the Kings. So a quick little one game home spot where the Grizzlies take on the Kings. Then they will head out to take on Boston this weekend. So we'll get Eric's thoughts on that. 305, we'll get into the list. I want to discuss that SEC-ACC challenge because I do think there are some big picture takeaways. And sometimes I think maybe whenever you have this type of tribalism, conference versus conference, I think sometimes maybe context gets lost. I actually think there were some takeaways from this one, and I want to discuss that with Cobb. So we'll do that during the list. Jason Smith's going to join us at 3:30. We'll talk Tigers Grizz with Jason. We'll tell your story, and then we will get out of here. But Cobb, I don't know if you've heard the biggest news of the day. Pour one out for East Memphis Business Lunches. Houston's is no more.
I heard that.
It's been a great run.
To see that. Yeah, great spot. I've been there a couple times. Always enjoyed it. Good food. What a tragedy, man. Like, what are you going to get to replace that type of restaurant? That's the problem, is like, sometimes when these places close down, it takes years to find another tenant for a space like that.
See, my understanding is also Houston's owned the building. So they'd be like, part of the reason. So for those that don't know and or care, briefly allow me. The Hillstone Group, which owns Houston's, is a fairly pretentious organization. Like, they like being in the big cities. They roll with that. They closed down the first ever Houston's, which was in Nashville, like, decades ago. And so the Memphis one, I think they would have loved to have closed many, many years ago, but it was always their most profitable location. They owned the building, and it was always jam-packed. So they never were able to close it. So the thing is, today, it's led to a lot of great takes, a lot of discourse online. And, of course, everyone always points out, like, crime first. It's like, I'm not saying, like, it's a non-factor, but, like, come on, y'all. Like, is crime worse today than it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago? Like, they just decided to shut it down. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can try to heavy-handedly, you know, produce the point that you want, but there's also been other points of high crime in Memphis, and Houston's was still rolling.
Like, yeah, they put out the public safety part of that message, though, where it's like, which is a little bit of a low blow. It's like, really?
Well, but that was also on brand for Houston's. No restaurant establishment in the world hates their customers more and gets more repeat business than Houston's. Like, that was their thing. It's like, you are a burden to them when you're in the building, yet I think it speaks volumes of kind of the consistency, the quality, the fact that, like, everyone still kept going. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was almost like, it's similar to me with my relationship with Apple and Mac, where I don't actually think anymore they make the best products, but I'm just indoctrinated. You know what I mean? So it's just like, I just keep buying it.
Yeah, no, I had a recent decision whether or not to go with another Apple product for my new tablet. And I thought about one of these remarkable tablets that you can write on that's like e-ink or whatever. And then I got down to it and I was like, I just can't break away from it.
Yeah, no, I'm addicted. Like, I admit I'm the problem.
Yeah. They need to come out with a new innovative phone, though. I'm tired of looking at the same brick all the time.
No, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, other than memory, camera quality, how is the phone really that much different than, like, when you go from 2006 to 2007, the leaps we made from cell phones was astronomical. But what's really that different from the iPhone, other than the camera quality, like, the operating system right now? But it's like, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I'm afraid to give up iMessage, too. That's part of it. I don't want to be that
one guy.
You
don't want to be the green guy?
Group text. Yeah, I don't want to be the green guy in the group text. That's a part of it. But man, it is disappointing when you see like a local staple shut down like that. And I feel like we're seeing more and more of that. Like, I feel like there's been some good downtown spots that have shuttered their doors as of late. And it's like, I don't know. It feels like Memphis needs a jolt of good business mojo, some good business energy right now. Cause like IP has had layoffs in the fairly, you know, recent past. And it's just like
FedEx,
you get that. Yeah, FedEx, you got the thing with Musk and the
Well, we got some good news yesterday that potentially manufacturers of microchips might be moving into town for
because
that.
Because of the SpaceX or the Elon Musk thing.
Yeah, so yeah, possibly NVIDIA, possibly Dell. Like, now, granted, this is all possible. Like, no one is planting the flag and said, here we come. But, you know, that... I'm not going to sit here and, like, to me, it's like, if that does occur, that's good. They're honoring South Korea for Memphis in May. This was before the martial law skirmish issues over there. It seems like maybe little Kimmy's bucking his head over in Korea, along with maybe Russia and China. So that seems awesome. But they're trying to get some South Korean business interest here as well. So, like, I do think people are trying, but you are combating, no question, you're combating a vibe right now, and the vibe is not great.
Yeah, and the other thing I worried about, it's not so much the city limits proper, but the Memphis area regional megasite that was is going to produce those Ford F-150 Lightnings.
Yep.
You know, the new administration is, they're probably going to cut that $7,500 EV credit, and already, like, the EV forecast has cooled quite a bit since Ford announced all that. So it's like, man, that was going to be huge. Like, there were going to be thousands of jobs in Shelby County, you know, for
like
Shelby County people.
High-paying ones, too.
Yeah, and for rural West Tennessee as well, created by that thing. And it still might happen. It just feels like that's going to be a long time out versus what we originally thought.
I also don't think the Mustang, when they redid that electric Mustang and it was like the worst selling car that Ford's had, I don't think that helped the cause. You know what I mean? Like, I think it goes beyond just the projection, because, like, in the end, one of Elon's or one of Trump's biggest benefactors is Mr. Electric Vehicle.
Yeah, right. So why is Elon Musk so okay with backing away from the EV thing when his entire business is predicated on selling EVs? I don't get that.
I think in the end, what it boils down to is he doesn't like the government demanding that you have it or, like, you know, promoting it. Like, I think he makes the product because he believes in the product. Like, you know, for a while before it was like getting mandated to do EVs, he's like looking at emissions rates and he's saying, well, I'm going to make an EV that people want to buy. And he's largely done that. And so I think there's that. I also think that, like, he has so many other ways of making money that probably plays into it a certain degree. But yeah, I mean, it's just, listen, like, to me, what bothers me is now anytime any event happens, it gets used as some type of, you know, microcosm example of what, like, everything's going on in the city. And I'm not sitting here and putting my head in the sand and saying, like, we don't have problems. It's obvious we have problems. But it's also become, like, very annoying because anytime anything happens, like, for instance, yesterday, like, if a CEO gets gunned down in downtown Memphis, it's a different story than when he gets gunned down in downtown Manhattan. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it happened yesterday, right? The United Healthcare CEO.
Correct.
And it's not people, oh, well, leave Manhattan.
Right.
Manhattan's got all these problems. I get that. It's kind of the same way we do the same thing at sports. The sky is falling, if you want the sky to be falling, right?
Yes.
Like, if there's a coach that you're ready to get rid of, any poor decision that they make, you just put that in the evidence category of why everything is gone. But I'll tell you this, man. It took me leaving Memphis, you know, at a young age to realize that, you know what? Memphis does not have a monopoly on the world's problems. In fact, every place has problems, no matter the size, no matter the location, no matter the politics. Everywhere you go, everywhere you could possibly live, even if it's on the Nerd Wallet list of best 10 places to live in America, you know what? It still has problems. And you know, that is worth remembering as something I had to leave to fully realize that Memphis actually, contrary to popular belief, does not have a monopoly on the world's problems.
It's almost like if you put human beings in a society, there's going to be conflict.
Yeah.
To me, I moved to LA and then you get out there quickly and you're like, oh man, this thing's romanticized. Like the weather's awesome, but like in terms of a place to live, you know, no thank you. I mean, you better be like filthy rich to live out there. And so,
yeah, and enjoy that $5.45 a gallon gas and the hour and 20 minute commute to get anywhere, you know. And so, yeah, there's pros and cons. I got an idea for you, though.
Right.
Pitch it to your people. What about a Birdie's East Memphis location for the old Houston spot? What do you think?
I wonder if the ceilings are high enough.
That's always the dilemma. Whenever I look at a house on realtor.com, I'm like, could I put a golf
just in case?
Here?
Like, just a thought. Like, I'm just saying right now. We have our new house has a detached garage. So not like we used to have a carport that was attached to the house, but now we have a detached garage. Nobody's parking in there.
Yeah. So whenever we go to look at houses, my wife's going to hate me for this, but I'm going to bring my driver.
Just in case. See what kind of room we've got. Is there enough room to make a swing? I don't know. Like, I'm with you. Like, I don't know what will go in there. I presume it's going to be some other type of restaurant, but that's kind of the other thing, man. It's not just that. I think part of the Houston's thing that's getting, like, once everybody puts down their pitchforks and tries to make their predetermined point, how many restaurants in a city stay open for 30-plus years?
Yeah, it's been a great run. You know, we see that everywhere, and you know, out with the old, in with the new, and whatever the new is, it'll come eventually. But yeah, it's not. Plenty of places to eat.
Especially
Memphis,
like,
right?
It's not quite fine dining, but it's clearly on the high end, particularly in our city. Like, it's not Huey's. You know what I mean? Like, in the end, like Huey, like, you know what? It's a burger place. Like, so, and they make it unbelievably consistently. But Houston's is gonna be on the upscale.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was one. We went there for an anniversary dinner once, you know, a few years ago, and I didn't remember being just overwhelmingly impressed. In fact, I think we had a gift card.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, what it was, I was at Audubon Dental Group, and I was like their 500th Invisalign patient something, and they gave me a gift basket. Shout out to Dr. Danny Balot.
Wait, they dared cheater to you?
Yeah, they gave me this gift basket. It was incredible, and part of it was a Houston's gift card, and we went there for our anniversary.
Well, the best about Houston's gift cards. They stopped doing this because, again, like, you know, if it was something the customers wanted, Houston's, like, got rid of it. Chicken tenders, absolutely not. We're getting that off the menu. Like, the cheese soup, get that off the menu. The best part about old school Houston's gift cards was if you didn't spend all of it, they just gave you cash back. And so, like, it was you know, your parents would give you the gift card. So, what do we got? Oh, I don't know. I didn't use it all. Yeah, I guess I did.
I got a medium Sprite.
Yeah.
And then I went to the movie store.
Yeah. Then I went to the Paradiso, and I got another big thing of popcorn. So, of course, that was the news, and that's allowed everyone to fire off their takes, but, you know, keep the dialogue going. So the other thing I was thinking about and wanted to discuss with you before we talk Tigers a little bit. I suppose it's because rivalry week happened a week later. We had the extra bye weeks. Because normally, right, we have championship week, then we have signing day. I just think we all know the calendar's out of whack, but Cobb, I had no idea signing day was yesterday, and it's my job. And obviously, you're at CBS Sports, so you're going to be more informed, but it didn't feel like signing day has almost by the year decreased. I felt like this was the first time that everybody was like, oh, signing day, huh?
Yeah, when even is it anymore? Nobody knows. At first, it was always in February. Then it moved to December 20th through 22nd. And now it's early December. And the thing is, most of these guys have already pretty much signed NIL agreements to the point where there is not really a ton of mystery or intrigue on actual signing day. And then you throw in the fact that the portal classes are essentially what's going to make or break your 2025 roster. So, like, signing day is still important or significant because it formalizes the players who might be able to help you in 26 or 27. But nothing that happened yesterday really feels like it's going to have all that big of an impact on the field in 25. And so when you know that the portal is ultimately going to be what decides it all, and the portal hasn't even technically opened yet, the luster on signing day is way gone. Plus, for me, I'm on paternity leave, and we're all like teamed up with 24/7 now. Yeah. So the amount of work that we got to do for it is minimized anyway. So it's
make sure it gets linked to the website.
Yeah, right. Like, make sure you throw that 24/7 hyperlink in there, and we're good to go. Right. So it's like, you know, we in years past made a much bigger deal out of it, but 100%, it's the significance of it has decreased over the years. Certainly in the way we treat it.
And I kind of have a working theory because I'm with you on the portal. It feels like in terms of next year's roster, the portal is what matters the most. But my new working theory is going to be, now that we're getting away from COVID eligibility, everybody having all the additional eligibility, also the opening up of the transfer waiver, so there was no limitations on the number of times you could transfer. Now that we're kind of cycling out of that, we're kind of getting to a point where most schools that really want to keep someone, at least at the power level, you know, obviously, I don't know if South Alabama is going to be able to keep, what's the running back's name, Fluff?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if South Alabama is keeping Fluff. But if Fluff were at Mississippi State, I think Mississippi State would figure out a way to keep him. You see what I'm saying?
And yeah, so, you know who you want to keep, right? So even though, like, Ole Miss last year lost Quinshon Judkins, they knew what they had to prioritize. Like, you can move the money around. You can see it. You know, you can plan this thing out a whole lot better than you could before. And then plus, you got the scholarship expansion as well, which is going to give them, you know, more room and flexibility to play with.
But so I'm starting to wonder if we're going to have a throwback to high school recruiting, because I'm now starting to operate. There's still going to be ways to fill in gaps with the portal. But I'm wondering if it's not going to be kind of the instant roster that it has been for the last few years. Like, I'm wondering now if it's going to be a situation where you start to realize more people that are in the portal for a reason, and there's going to be less instant help from the portal. You're still going to be able to fill in some pieces and whatnot, but like I'm almost wondering if the Georges of the world, and for all the jokes on Brian Kelly last year, portal time, like I'm starting to wonder if maybe they're going to be at an advantage, because Topmeyer and I were talking about this. Is it possible maybe that like Navy and Army's early success this year was just from continuity? And we see so many teams that are clunky early, and does the schedule work out to where you're able to kind of build and gel a team early enough, and then you kind of get into your schedule? Or like I'm starting to wonder if maybe the teams that have been more heavily focused, and I'm not like including Clemson because Dabo's like an extreme, but Kelly has kind of adopted a similar approach in that we are more focused on building through the high school development that way. Unlike Dabo, he'll add some portal guys, but they're much more likely to spend on a high school kid than they are a portal kid. And so like I am wondering if maybe the people that have been so dependent, like I think this is what's fascinating for Mike Norvell next year at Florida State. I mean, how many games does he have to win? And then on top of that, you know that he's going to have to go right back into the portal again to try and patch it up. Now, the one advantage I do think he has is, man, I think the ACC, like, I think they got some real problems in terms of, I don't think it's a mistake that SMU is all of a sudden playing for the title, because SMU, I think, spending more money on their roster, and it's kind of where I disagree with the Herb Streets of the world that are saying, like, oh, all this talk about the ACC being bad, all I see is 9-3 Syracuse, 8-4 Duke. And I'm just the one raising the hands like, you seen the bottom of the league? What happened is some 6-6 and 7-5 teams were able to take advantage of some absolute dog-ass teams, and it propped their record up. And right. So if you're Norvell, I don't think it's that difficult considering what they're going to spend on their roster. If you get it right, I don't think it's that difficult for him to have a top three ACC team. But the question is like, what is that fan base going to want from him?
Well, my other question with Florida State is, do you really think Gus Malzahn in 2025 is the answer at offensive coordinator? I mean, come on. This is not 2011 anymore. I mean, if it's not clear by now, I don't know when it will be. The game has passed Gus by. I mean, his stuff doesn't work anymore. He had all the talent he needed in the backfield at UCF to be among the Big 12 title contenders this year, and he couldn't get it done. So, like, that's my concern. And on top of that, Mike Norvell is supposed to be the offensive mind. Like, if Mike Norvell has backed himself into this shell to where he doesn't even have any confidence as a play caller anymore, and he has to go out and hire Gus Malzahn, like, what are we doing?
So I think what you saw there is the Ryan Day. Fan base is mad, and Norvell's a Gus guy. And so he went and he got his mentor.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this about Gus. I've never been the world's biggest fan of the offense. Like, your colleague Chip Patterson has absolutely nailed it. Like, he is 100% the Indiana, French Lick, Kiowa, Pete Dye. He's the Pete Dye of the putt-putt offense.
Like, offense, yeah.
He's the Pete Dye of it. I think the problem that they had at UCF is for that offense to work, you have to be able to really run the football. And I think it's going to be a lot easier for Gus to get the running game going with Florida State's roster than it was at UCF versus the rest of the Big 12. And that's kind of the other thing is, hey, man, he goes into the Big 12 and they've been running this style of offense since the early 2010s, or if not sooner. And so they have all the adjustments to it, whereas if you tell me he's going to be able to get enough offensive line play and they're going to get a good back, I don't think it's as disastrous of a hire as maybe the mood feels. But I mean, I'm with you. It's not like, you know, it's not like late stage Auburn was putting up massive numbers. It is like, yeah, it works really well when Cam Newton's running it. I think 99.9% of offenses run well.
Well, yeah, who's going to be the quarterback? That's a huge question. I'm more of a Donald Ross guy, by the way. But, well, I get your point.
Who did he have as the Donald Ross? So they said Lincoln is the Fazio, the flashy putt-putt
okay.
offense.
Okay.
Who?
Well, Donald Ross is like a classic.
No, you know, but it was like classic. There's more to it that meets the eye of the putt-putt offense. God, who was it?
Well, Chip Kelly and Ryan Day, that analogy makes sense, but how has it ultimately worked out for Ohio State, man? I mean, they couldn't get it done with the game on the line against Michigan, and now all of a sudden Ryan Day is against the hot seat. Now you got Mike Norvell, who hasn't accomplished nearly what Ryan Day has accomplished at a program with similar expectations that's in a weaker league, and you're turning to a coordinator in Gus Malzahn, who I think is even less spectacular of a hire at this point than Chip Kelly was a year ago. So to me, that was almost a white flag of sorts for Mike Norvell to say, hey, Gus Malzahn is the answer to me being on the hot seat in 2025.
I think the question is, if Ohio State beats Michigan by just doing what they should have done, which, no duh, was not run between the tackles, maybe attack the secondary that's got two first-rounders injured and has been lit up by Luke Altmyer. Like, maybe attack it that way. Are we feeling differently? Because I don't believe Chip Kelly's offense is as outdated as the narrative is. What I do think the problem with Chip Kelly's offense is you have to be very good up front. Like, when UCLA was starting to kind of improve, it's because he started to get better offensive linemen and they were able to do what he wanted to do. But it requires really athletic offensive linemen, and it requires good backs. And what we've seen at Ohio State was maybe they have the back part, but their offensive line, through injuries, through maybe misidentifications of talent, that offensive line is just not very good by the standard of what they paid for it. Like, let's be clear. Like, is their offensive line better than 95% of college football? Yes, but that's not what they were paying for. They were paying for the best roster in football. So with Gus, I think it makes some sense to me of, okay, have him call ball plays and don't have to worry about the stuff that he doesn't like, just have him call ball plays. I think we'd feel a little bit better about it if Ohio State just beats Michigan.
No, that's fair. The thing, though, that is different at Florida State than it was different for Ryan Day and Chip Kelly going into this season at
Ohio
State.
They weren't 2-10?
That, and for as flawed and just kind of meh as Will Howard is at quarterback, I feel 1,000 times better going into a season with Will Howard at quarterback than I do about Florida State's current quarterback situation. We'll see what they end up doing in the portal, but when I look at the state of Florida and another coach who is kind of on the hot seat in Billy Napier, the big difference that I see is the hope that is signified in DJ Lagway and how DJ Lagway has been the impetus behind their late rally in recruiting and how they somehow have now signed a top 10 class. And it's like, you don't have that magnetic superstar to keep other prospects engaged, to keep your fans engaged, to give you hope. Like, where is that source of hope right now if you're Florida State? And I don't know what sort of bags you're going to be waving around in the portal, but the attempt they made last year failed miserably in DJ Uiagalelei. And so it's like, I watched enough of those two. Brock Glenn, shout out Covington, but, like, you know, he's not it.
It's very obvious they're getting a new quarterback.
Yeah, it's just like,
I'm watching Milroe.
Really?
I'm watching
you think Jalen Milroe? Yeah, like, you think that could really happen? That he would go in the portal over going in the draft? What do the mocks say about Jalen Milroe right now? Because I've heard this idea that, like, you know what, Jalen Milroe might not be Alabama's quarterback next year, and it's not because he's going to the NFL. It's because he might go to the portal. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, like, that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Like, can you help me make some sense of that idea?
All right, so do I think he's a first round quarterback? No. What could work in his favor is it is not a great quarterback draft, and a lot of teams are going to be resetting. I still, though, believe The idea that he's going to be a first rounder is insane to me. He's just not a good enough thrower. And there have been guys that aren't perfect throwers, but he's worse than they are. Like, Will Levis was a better thrower than Milroe is. And I just pay attention to DeBoer's frustrations on the... There's been a decent amount of throwing Milroe under the bus, and I just wonder if it's the, hey, we appreciate our time together, but let's move on.
Yeah, and but at the same time, where would Alabama be right now without Jalen Milroe?
Well, I mean, that's kind of, it's the classic, well, what if DeBoer's making the same mistake that... making the same mistake that Ryan Day made, which is you put all the problems on Kyle McCord and you wind up with a Will Howard. I mean, are we convinced that was an upgrade? Because you and I in real time, it's not like this is revisionist history. You and I in real time were like, I just don't understand spending this amount of money and then giving it to a quarterback that at the bare minimum, Kansas State said, we wish you well.
And then Kyle McCord goes and leads Syracuse to a 9-3 record, an upset victory over Miami. All of a sudden, he looks like he might actually be the better player. Yeah, I have a hard time.
I do think if I'm going to defend them, which I'm not because I don't, but I would at least acknowledge this is a legitimate argument. Kyle may be a better thrower than Will Howard, but... For us to maximize, we have the best receivers. We don't need great throwers. We need somebody to just fire it out there and let the guys make plays. But what we really need is somebody to be plus one in the run game and somebody that can really run the football. That would be the argument. But, I mean, I think Kyle McCord wins the game Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, Ryan Day said it was pretty windy. That messed with their passing attack. Right?
He did also, he finally... After on his signing day, he said they may have their ratio may have been out of balance.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll make the Ohio State fans feel better.
He is not blind. Okay, we have confirmed. Does have eyeballs.
That'll make the Ohio State fans feel a whole lot better about their fourth straight loss to Michigan. Oh, man. I have a hard time seeing Jalen Milroe playing for another team. However, it becomes a financial question, kind of like it is oftentimes for big men in college basketball who don't quite have that lofty lottery level draft standing, and they've got that extra year of eligibility. And it's like, well, you can make enough money now in the college game to justify putting off your professional ambitions for another year. So we haven't really seen a case like that in college football yet. Jalen Milroe would be a heck of a precedent setter there, though, to be a draft eligible guy of that caliber to turn down the draft to transfer and go play another year somewhere else. It makes me think of kind of the splash that Hunter Dickinson made when he transferred from Michigan to Kansas when he was draft eligible and, you know, has become obviously remained one of the better players in college basketball. It would be seismic if he did that. And you think about like the price tag associated with somebody like Nico, who was unheralded, you know, $8 million or whatever. I mean, what could Jalen Milroe command on the open market as basically a 1-year free agent? If you're a program that's desperate enough, like Florida State is, you know, your boosters have all that money. They're trying to throw money at you to leave the ACC. Well, hold off on that for a second. Why don't you throw some of that money in the Jalen Milroe fund and you know, let's get this thing back on track. Sure, why not? I can see it.
I mean, I don't. Whatever the number Cam Ward got, right?
Yeah, and it was worth it, right? Because I mean, Miami is not going to make the playoff, but he got him dang near to it. So I mean, you know, and completely turned around the Mario Cristobal era, 100%. So yeah, that would be wild. Sure, why not? Let's do it. Jalen Milroe to the portal.
All right, let's take a quick break. Let's talk some Grizzlies. Grizzlies and Kings tonight. Eric joins us next. Stick around. You're listening to Jeffrey Wright and Company on 92.9 FM.
Yeah. I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for true crime news. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ESPN, right here on 92.9 FM, ESPN. Tip off with Eric at 7 p.m. Eric, you were in the building on Tuesday, and I'm curious to know, watching on television, like when Rob did his first sideline report, you know, like right when they go from the pregame to right before tip-off, like you could tell the arena was so loud that like Rob couldn't really hear himself probably in his monitors. That felt like more than a regular season game to me. And I'm not even saying, I don't even think it was the cup. I think it was the fact that I think everybody's excited to see that game.
Yeah, I thought so. Two teams playing high-level basketball. Both teams coming in riding streaks. Dallas was 8-9, I think four straight, then lost in four straight. And, you know, the Grizzlies were playing well and fell behind a little early, went back and forth, and then kind of really took control in that third quarter. And, yeah, it was an intense game in terms of a regular season game for sure. And you could feel the frustration of the fans in that third quarter towards the home team, but then you could feel the jubilation when they flipped the script too. So yeah, it was fun. It's not fun to be on the end of it, but the game itself was fun, and you could kind of feel it going the wrong way. And you know, I heard a lot of the talk and how the officials this, that, whatever. You know, here's the thing: when you take a couple of fouls underneath to prevent a guy from getting a dunk because he got away from an assignment or got an offensive rebound, but it's better to foul him. Those count towards the team fouls. So now the reach-in fouls, you know, that add up quicker, they put you in a position, and Dallas has guys that really know how to manipulate that. So tough to see 20-plus free throws in any quarter, some of that towards the end, but nonetheless, I thought the Grizzlies have a tendency when things start rolling the wrong way, especially on the road, where maybe they get away from the flow of the offense and a guy tries to get a quick bucket to squelch that momentum, and maybe it's not the best quick bucket opportunity. I don't blame them for being aggressive like that. I think that's part of the learning curve with this offense right now, is figuring out how to really pick and choose that time. And there's still some, you know, there's still some times where you can see guys that haven't played together, it comes to fruition. I think there was a play underneath where Ja elevated and was fading away, and Jalen Wells, you know, 100% in his mind, thought he's shooting this, and he hits him in the hands. And he bobbles the ball, and then it turns into a turnover or a block shot or something. And that's not Jalen nor Ja's fault. I mean, at that point, you hope Ja kind of shoots it, but when he sees the right play, he makes the right play. He just has the ability to hang in the air longer than most human beings on the planet. And teammates sometimes don't realize he even has that because they haven't spent a lot of time on the court together. You know, I still contend with this group where they're at right now is certainly better than I expected. I think they probably expected to maybe even be a little bit better because of the losses we've talked about in the past about Chicago and Brooklyn. And you caught some teams at times where they weren't playing their best basketball, Philadelphia, Milwaukee. But I think they're only going to get better. I think this offense is going to keep clicking and keep getting better, and guys are going to really understand how to find the right spots and the right shots. And man, they're fun to watch. It stinks when they lose, but they're still a fun team to watch.
Eric, I was playing around with the Grizzlies stats and was kind of blown away to see that of the rotation guys, Brandon Clark has the highest net rating of anyone on the team. You don't always see it from a points standpoint with BC, but holler at me about the impact that he's had, especially coming back from a pretty serious injury and sort of the effect that he has on this team when he's on the floor.
Well, first, congratulations, correct? They're in order.
Yeah,
so you playing
yeah,
around with stats, get ready to start playing around with toys and a lot more.
Stepping on them.
And stepping on them, which is not fun during Christmas, by the way. But congrats, man, to you and your wife. That's Parenthood's such an awesome journey. So I was,
thank you.
You know,
thank
you and Gabe at the same time. I got to see Gabe the other night, too. So I'd be remiss without saying that. But he does,
by the way, Josie
impact.
Went to her first game Sunday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
There you go.
She was,
got a win. She's
she was into it.
She was 1-0. That's all that matters.
1-0.
Stay perfect, child.
That's right.
I think the impact Brandon has really, it doesn't go on the stat sheet because you have to be cognizant of where he is. I think he got caught a little early in the season trying to bring back that three-point shot. He hasn't taken one in quite a while. They've kind of taken him out of that corner role. It's just not something – he's super comfortable with. He's said that in the past. They tried to work on it. That's kind of where the offense goes. So he's gotten back to the stuff that makes BC what makes him special. That little running floater, that little drop off, the ability to cross the glass. But if you forget about him, if you're on the defensive end, he's going to make you pay. I think teams know that. So it does. You're not allowed to just double off a guy you don't really fear. Now, with Zach Edey, obviously they're not going to double off him underneath because he's so big. But Brandon is so athletic, and the way he rolls, it helps. And so he's out there with the starters. He's basically, when you look at it, break down the starting five, he's the fifth option. I think Jalen Wells is the fourth. I think, obviously, Dez and Jaren and Ja are the first three. And so he's not closing out as many games as maybe like Santi does sometimes because of the way he's been playing. But this is part of that strength for this team of depth that comes into play where you know you can go to him. You know you can trust him. He's a little undersized if he's guarding someone like Derek Lively or Gafford, and that came in a couple of times. But, you know, Brandon's going to give you everything he's got every time, and I'm happy for him to get back. He's still working through that. I mean, this is an Achilles injury, guys, and Taylor alluded to it the other night in Dallas that, you know, I think it's always interesting when we go on the road to hear the questions that we've asked here in Memphis from opposing reporters reporters for the opposing team that want to know. And I thought Taylor said it best, like, hey, he's still, you know, feeling his way through the handful of games he played at the end of the year last year certainly helped that and gave him a nice push into the summer, but he's still getting comfortable with his body again. And I know it sounds crazy to people because these are finely tuned athletes and all this stuff. An Achilles injury, for those that don't understand, which I think is almost disrespectful to your audience because I think they understand the severity of it, but it is literally the injury a basketball player fears the most. You don't fear your knees as much. You don't like the thought of getting undercut, but the fear of an Achilles injury, when your Achilles is sore, you watch guys and just the look in their eyes, like, please no, like, please not this, because they know the recovery time, because they know how long it takes to get it back to full strength, if you can even ever get it back to full strength. We've seen so many examples of guys who are never the same player. They just can't get it back to where it was before that injury occurred. And I think he's still feeling that. He still has bounce. Is it the same bounce? Probably not. I think that would be unfair. Could it be the same bounce again? It appears like it could, but we don't know. So I think his mentality, his work ethic, the way he goes about it, that's a big factor. And having him out there, you know, it allows Jaren to roam a little bit. We've seen his block numbers go up. It allows, you know, he can step out to 15 feet, which opens up the lane for Ja a little bit more, whereas with Zach, he's not really going to step out to 15 feet as much. So it's an interesting dynamic because, you know, Zach Edey's not far from returning. And when he returns, do you keep it the same way? Do you keep Zach Edey coming off the bench and have him as a secondary unit guy, but plays, you know, more minutes than most secondary unit guys? Again, these are the things. Some days I look at Taylor Jenkins and just go, but I don't envy you having to make these decisions because you're trying to be the best coach you can possibly be, but you're also trying to do the best job for your players, not only as a team, but as individuals as well. I mean, this is their livelihood. And so it's a tough situation. And, you know, guys are going to have to be pros about it. And I think that Brandon's numbers, you know, certainly speak a lot to how valuable he is to this group and what he can bring to the table and why he should be in the lineup for at least 20 minutes a night.
We're talking, of course, to Eric Hasseltine tonight, Grizzlies and Kings. You can hear pregame at 6:30, tip-off at 7 o'clock. Does Dez look good to you, health-wise?
I think it's coming through that oblique. I think it's coming along. I thought the shot looked better in Dallas. But, yeah, it looked like there was some fighting through that, too. Again,
yeah.
Another injury where you're talking about your core, and if you're a shooter the way Dez is, it's a pretty big body.
Well, I mean, literally it affects everything in the shot.
Yes, 100%. And so, yeah, I think he's there. And, I for Dez, knowing him, I feel like on enough of a personal level to say this, he's pressing because he's not happy that the shots that he normally makes are not falling right now. And he did kind of allude to that, like, hey, I've gone through this before. It'll come around, and, you know, everybody relax, kind of like the Aaron Rodgers stuff. But you know he's thinking about it, too. And he wouldn't be Desmond Bane if he didn't. And that's what makes him, you know, so valuable to this group. And that's why I also have talked to others and said, you better watch out. You know, I talked to some guys in Sacramento today. So when this team gets fully healthy, you get G.G. Jackson back, and then the question becomes, does he work his way into that starting five and Jalen Wells goes to the second unit? When you get Vince Williams back, where do his minutes come from if you're going to bring him and put him on the floor? But when you get that full complement of players, this team's dangerous. And when Dez is back to being Dez and this group really understands the offense a lot like Indiana last year, I think they're poised for a big start to the new calendar year. You know, as that road trip maybe starts to come to a close and guys start getting closer and closer and we start getting towards the All-Star break, you know, this team's a team that can rattle off a big streak if they're playing the game the way they've been playing it and even improve upon that. So I think he'll get there, to answer your question, and I think it's just a matter of time and trusting it and feeling comfortable again. And sometimes that happens with these muscle injuries that affect what you're doing. Ankles, you can see guys being tentative at first, knees, things like that. But I have no doubt in my mind that 22 will be, you know, dropping 22 a night, no problem, pretty soon.
Eric, you've kind of alluded to it already, but there's nobody on this Grizzlies team averaging more than 28 and a half minutes per game. That's Jaren. Mm-hmm. As this injury list continues to shrink, thank goodness, it's about time. I mean, how does Taylor manage all the rotation questions that are naturally going to be there? I mean, he's been playing 11 guys in some situations, but you know he's going to have 14 potentially healthy rotation caliber guys here in the very near mm-hmm. future. I mean, what does that look like from a coach's standpoint, and how do you foresee him juggling that?
A nightmare at times, but a nightmare that's not really a nightmare. It's just a dream where you're struggling through a problem. That's a good problem to have, I guess. I think it looks like you get these guys the feeling of playing at this pace and they understand it. And again, I use Indiana as the example because they were the most recent team to memory, and even in a long time for that matter, that really ramped up their pace so significantly from, you know, a single year prior to the next year. And, you know, I go back to when we were talking in mid-November and you had, you know, talking heads, pundits, podcasters, take your pick. Everybody coming at Taylor Jenkins with, why isn't this guy playing more minutes? Why isn't that guy playing more minutes? Taylor Jenkins is, you know, ruining this, ruining that. I'm like, dude, you guys realize we played 6 games in 8 days to start the season with a super fast-paced offense. Then he had guys hurt. Then, you know, guys are still figuring it out. I mean, Marcus Smart did not look like Marcus Smart now, and he didn't have a great game in Dallas. Obviously, he had a poor game in Dallas, but he doesn't look like he has looked over the last week when he first got back. This offense takes its toll on you. I remember seeing in the first 12, 13 games, guys doubled over at the waist, hands on the knees, and you just don't see that a lot unless you're out there playing it. So I don't think they really trust playing guys 30-plus minutes right now because they don't want to wear them out. And, yeah, you might take some losses earlier in the year, and that might affect something down the stretch. We know that. Yes, it's a marathon, but one or two games in that marathon can change the complexion of what your playoff picture is or even making the playoffs. We've seen that in the West. But I think as it gets there, the rotation will be dropped down, but you have those guys ready to go in case of a nagging injury, in case of a guy just needing a night off to maintain his body, and you've got guys you're comfortable playing. I think the best example goes to Scottie Pippen, who, you know, goes for a career high 30 in Chicago on a night where Ja doesn't play, triple doubles up, and all of a sudden then, you know, the next night he plays like 12 minutes, and he plays them to the best of his ability and is a pro about it. But I'm sure in his head he's like, man, I just dropped 30 and I just got my minutes cut, you know, like by 40-50%, and that's tough. But that's part of it. And, you know, they talk about all the time with the group, the players, they all say the same thing, the coaches, for the greater good, for the good of the team, not for the good of the individual. And I do think they believe that. And I think that's the hardest job for a coach. And I've said this on the show and on others, and we'll continue to say it, the greatest thing Lionel Hollins ever told me, and he told me a lot of great stuff, was the hardest job for a coach is getting guys to accept their role, because none of these guys walked into the NBA because they were role players in high school or college. They were the stars. They were the studs. They were the guys that had the ball in their hands. Now you're going and there's only one or two of those guys down the stretch that you're going, this is the guy that we're running the play for. And you have 14 of those guys on the roster that have done that all their life, that now only two of them are doing it. You have to be able to accept that mental part of the game. And I think they're there. You know, I think Jake LaRavia is a good example of that, where a lot of people question whether he could even play in the league, and he's helping this team win games on a regular basis. And so I think whatever the decision is, I think there's certain nights where you feel like, okay, we're going to have an edge here. This is the way we play, the way we match up with this opponent. We might be able to get guys some extra time. Whereas in other games where this team gives us problems, that may not be best record-wise, best, you know, team-wise, but matchup-wise, and we're going to have to use different looks and we're going to have to use different rotations to maximize our opportunity to win. And I think that's all part of the strategy. And, you know, I'm sure people understand this and you guys know this. They're not just waking up today and going, okay, let's get ready for Sacramento. They've been preparing for this game for like the last 3 days. The coach that has the scout, the group itself, they're looking at iPads, they're watching tape. This is not just, hey, we just got done in Dallas and now we'll wait to start Sacramento till day of the game. They were already working on it before the Dallas game. So they're mapping this out with a strategy in mind and a game plan in mind. And I think it's hard to argue that it's not working, because they're 14-8 right now. You feel like they could be 16-6 if they had, you know, held on to a couple of leads. And talk about Chicago and Dallas, but those things are going to happen. And you know, maybe not played poorly against Denver or Brooklyn in one of those two games. So that's an 82-game season. Those things happen, and so you move on past them and you face the next challenge. But they're already looking at Boston, which is going to be obviously a very tough game. And then how are you going to manage the minutes in Boston with the second night of a back-to-back and a late arrival into Washington, D.C. Sunday, where the team you know you should be able to score against, but you may have to rely on that depth a little more because you play the starters longer in Boston. So it'll be interesting to see what happens these next four nights.
Wrapping up here with Eric Hasseltine, Grizzlies taking on the Kings tonight. Pregame right here on 99 FM ESPN at 6:30. Tip-off with Eric at 7. Eric, this has been a competitive matchup. Really, you know, De'Aaron Fox seems to clearly take this one personally. The Kings come in with not a great record, but they still have a positive point differential. They're probably a team that might be a little bit better than what their record is. What are you looking for tonight?
I think they're better than a record. Obviously, they have a new piece in DeMar DeRozan and figuring that out. Malik Monk's had to step in and start some games where he's more of their super sub. I think it's an interesting matchup. Like you said, I've always felt like De'Aaron Fox takes this as a challenge. He's an all-star caliber player. He's one of the best point guards in our league and one of the best scoring guards in our league. And yet you hear way more hype. I can't remember the last time I saw De'Aaron Fox on like a national commercial, and Ja gets that attention. And De'Aaron's like, hey, whoa, wait a minute. When we go head to head, I've won my share of games against this guy too. Let's not forget about me because I'm in Sacramento. Well, it's, you know, we're in Memphis. These are two smaller market teams, so you have to fight for that. I expect De'Aaron to take that challenge. I think the X factor for them is always, you know, Domantas Sabonis, the way he makes extra plays, gets his hands on offensive rebounds. I think last year he had a night where we thought he could easily get to 30 rebounds, and they were up and they pulled him, and so he didn't. But he's so physical and so tough. I mean, go look at the highlights if you haven't seen what happened, and the league came down with fines today of what happened against